So welcome to the afternoon session. I don't know if you can hear me. I'll have to speak loudly. So it's a pleasure to introduce the next speaker, Pranavadasa, who's also known as Ferdinando Sardella, who received his master's degree at the University of Gothenburg in Stockholm and also studied Indology in Sanskrit at Stockholm University. And he recently completed his doctorate in religious studies at the University of Gothenburg, finished in February this year. And he has a dissertation on Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, The Context and Significance of a Modern Hindu Personalist. So it's a wonderful contribution to Gaudiya studies that he's hopefully going to publish soon. And also he received a prestigious award from the Donner Institute in Finland for the excellence of his dissertation. So it's already been recognized by the Academy. And you're going to speak today. I don't have the... Preaching conversion or education? Preaching conversion or education? Yes. Question mark. I'll let you continue.
Thank you.
So we don't have the audio system working, so we're trying to speak loud. And if my voice gets quieter, let me know. So I'm very glad to be here today, and very honored. I think that the best way to for me to have a nice birthday is to speak about the person that has engaged me for 6 years, which I came to highly respect and appreciate. He's enthusiastic for these 4 years.
So here you see a picture of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati and a mixture of Indian and Western.
This is a picture from Calcutta and shows Bhaktisiddhanta inviting British friends and Indian friends and mixing together and speaking about various topics, but ultimately about the Russians. In a kind of very formal way, but you see the setup. It's a table, there's maybe some kind of tea, and there are devotees dressed very formal, serving. It's a very formal setup, just to kind of make, especially the Westerners, feel at ease. So 2 years ago, I presented the thesis of my research at the conference for the Islam studies. There were some things which were left incomplete. So one of those things was a statement which I mentioned last time about institutions and the way Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati seemingly was critiquing modern institutions, perhaps indirectly critiquing his own institution perhaps. So I would like to take back this, to show again this quotation and then kind of go from there. So the original purpose of the established churches of the world may not always be objectionable. But no stable religious arrangement for instructing the masses has yet been successful. The bona fide teacher of religion is neither any product of, nor the favorer of, any mechanical system. In his hands, no system has, likewise, the chance of degenerating into a lifeless arrangement. The mere pursuit of fixed doctrines and fixed liturgies cannot hold a person to the true spirit of doctrine or liturgy. The idea of an organized church in an intelligible form, indeed, marks the close of the living spiritual movement. This is a very strong statement about the fact that religious institutions, in general, can become very stiff. In scholarly terms, we talk about scrutinization of charisma, institutionalization, where one in an institution one creates certain kind of hierarchies and routines that are repeated mechanically. And to this, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati objected that it's very important that there is
spiritual, especially religious organization or a church in this case, maintains the kind of creativity, emotive spirit,
the sense of looking at things in a fresh way and not just mechanically replicating itself. So today I would like to discuss a particular argument which I'm taking kind of some points from my thesis, but specially adapted for this conference. So my argument would be that Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati used a differentiated model of preaching. And then I have to define the words here, the key terms of the conference: preaching, education, and conversion. So from here, in this sense, in the sense of my presentation, preaching would mean, broadly speaking, religious communication. And it can be done in different ways. Also, as Barbara was mentioning, in terms of bhakti, just sharing. then education, religious education, of course, theoretical and practical aspect of personalist bhakti. Education, here I mean both the general approach, where one tries to explain to outsiders the meaning or specific or fundamental points of bhakti and how they resonate. It can also mean, of course, in any kind of insider education, where people who have converted to the tradition, they get trained in the practice and philosophy of the tradition. But here, specifically, I focus on education, like more in a broader, sense. And conversion. Conversion here, I intend in the sense of change of heart. Going through a rite de passage, in academic terms, that means going through a nimitta stage, where one leaves behind a certain kind of lifestyle, and go through a crisis or a kind of interim nimitta stage, and then go through a change, and change his lifestyle. And there is a fundamental change in social associations, relationships, cultural affiliations, and so on. So, I would argue that Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati believed in innovation, creativity, and attentive awareness of the social, cultural, and political context, and they were keys to a successful missionary effort. And that he also, as we read in the previous quote, he believed that routinization and institutionalization could be potential dangers that could stifle that spirit of bhakti, that flow of bhakti, from the guru, from the community of the gopis, out to the world. And what is the relevance for Islam today? It may have some, to understand this point, may have some relevance for ISKCON in terms of its engagement, long-term engagement with the West, with Western culture. And also its relationship with social, political, and cultural life. And here I mean specifically maybe a certain tendency in certain areas of ISKCON, perhaps more in the West than in other parts of the ISKCON world, where ISKCON has become gradually more segregated from the Western society, from mainstream culture, has become more isolated. And it doesn't have to be like that. And I would like to bring this as an example of a way of interacting at a different level, in a very creative way, with the outside world. And in some sense, in a very successful way. So as I'm going through my presentation, I would like to ask you to keep in mind these points, which I will cover in different ways. And I will try to show that the Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati understood the preaching, sharing, or communicates with Gaudiya Vaishnavism on three different levels. The first level was a kind of broader level that was addressed to scholars, educated people from the middle and upper classes in India.
Even kind of massive presentation of Gaudiya Vaishnavism meant for the masses in a kind of random way, in order to reach as many people as possible without being discriminated. But also being very selective at times, and addressing scholars, academics, or politicians. And I will discuss briefly as a case study his approach to Europe, to Germany, and England. The second strategy was education to sympathizers in India. And here I will mention briefly the Bhaktivinoda Institute that we started in Mayapur, which was open broadly to Hindu and Vaishnava youth, but even Muslims. And the third level was the inner circle of the Gaudiya, where actually devotees went through a process of conversion, and I will show also that conversion meant different things, to get a more specific education and training in Bhakti. So I will first address Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati education and his own process of conversion and transformation. Then I will speak about the education in the Gaudiya Math, how it was understood and how it was practiced. Then I will touch on some of the experiences in Germany and Britain. And also at the end bring some points, kind of points for discussion or thoughtful reflection about this one and its future. So all this is 1 hour, so it's kind of big. Last time when I spoke about my project, I had encountered some significant obstacles. The first obstacle was to find the sources for my research project. And my supervisor were very worried about me because I wanted to do some research and I didn't really have the material.
So one section of my work was to actually explore the life of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, but more in depth. In other words, just reading the standard explanation wouldn't be enough. As you know, as a scholar, you need primary sources. And the absolutely best primary source is something written by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati about himself. It would be the absolutely best primary source. And I read a few times in different places that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was an autobiography. And the devotees were explaining in different writings that they asked Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati to do it because the tendency is that when you write something about someone who is passed away today, then the tendency is to eulogize or apotheosis, to make things bigger. But they thought that if Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati would write his own life, it would be more authentic and more suitable. And he agreed to that. Unfortunately, despite all my efforts, I haven't been able to find it. It's very frustrating for a scholar, as you know. But I found what is the closest to that. And this was something called Saraswati Jayashri, which was a very ambitious program of 4 to 5 volumes depicting the life of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And one volume had been published, and that covered a period from 1911 to 1925-26. But the other volumes were not published. In other words, they might have disappeared. So I had the fortune to be instrumental in acquiring the library of the secretary of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, which was in the Sundar Nanda Vidino. And in that library, we found a piece describing the early life of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati based on the autobiography that consistently mentioned the words of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. So it's 100 pages covering his birth till about 1900. And that could be considered to be a very reliable material, especially because it says in the cover, it's there on the first page, it's there on the right, that has been edited by Bhaktisiddhanta himself. So in the book you find his notes It's a nice book, and I'm preparing now for publication. The other thing we found in the library of Sundarananda Vidyavinod was his the diary of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati covering the years from 1904 to 1935, where he kind of day by day is kind of technical way describing what he was doing and what kind of expenses he had, what kind of people he met, and sometimes making comments about his own realization. It's like short, but still very useful and very valuable. So that this discovery came at the very end of my doctoral thesis, so like in October, and I had to finish by December. So, but still, I could jam in something of it. It was very exciting. So what does this tell us about his life? I will not tell you the whole story because it's 100 pages, but some points which are relevant for this conference is that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was born in a very wealthy and prestigious family, the family of Bhaktivinoda Kaur, who was the judge in the British administration. And Bhaktivinoda Kaur went himself through a process of conversion, if you like, because from being born in a Shaiva family, he discovered Chaitanya Vaishnavism, at a later stage of his life, and then became very, very focused on Chaitanya Bhakti. By the time Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was born in Dharanapuri, in Orissa, on the east coast of India, then Bhaktivinoda Kaur was studying with some pandits. He was looking for the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he was reading the Srimad Bhagavatam, studying Sanskrit and composing texts in Sanskrit and poems and so on. So by the age of 7, Bhaktivinoda Kaur was practicing bhakti yoga, and he gave, as it says here, this is a quote from this biographical part. Bhaktivinoda from Puri brought 2 siddhis and gave Harinam to the 7-year-old son of Saraswati Thakur. Bhaktivinoda gave also Narasimha Mantra to Saraswati Thakur. So in other words, it appears that Bhaktivinoda Kaur had the ambition to train his son, Bhaktisiddhanta, Vinod Prasad Datta, named before becoming Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and developed a kind of relationship like a kind of guru and disciple. This is called the Saraswati Sri Bhagavat, the relation with the early life of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, which is really not mentioned anywhere else. He gave a very detailed description of his early years, what were his interests, what kind of books he was reading, what kind of people he was associating with, what kind of discussions they had. I found it very, very exciting. The picture we have is that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was exposed to a lot of cultural influences. He was a very, very intelligent person, and he was devouring, reading many books, all kinds of books in different languages. He developed early a passion for astronomy, chess. He loved rational thinking, so he understood chess as a way to practice intellectual thinking, and he was practicing with his friends. Mathematics, debates. He developed early on a passion for debates. And the background of it was that Bhaktivinoda Kaur was studying his own books with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. So at a very early age, as he was writing a book called the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he was studying it with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And there you find many different arguments discussing contemporary culture, contemporary society, our religion, and arguments to kind of present Chaitanya Bhakti in its integrity and authenticity. Bhaktivinoda Kaur always understood his work as a recovery of a lost tradition. He never understood his own work as creating something completely new, but recovering something that had been lost. In fact, as we probably have read, when he tried to find a copy of Chaitanya Charitamrita, he couldn't. It was very difficult to find it in those days. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati used to go to a place called
Vedanta Square in Kolkata. And that was a place where all kinds of people would meet together in the square and just debate with each other. And he loved to debate. And he writes in his autobiography that he couldn't stand anybody speaking bad about Krishna Bhakti. So whenever there was somebody who would present some kind of opinion that could be a misreading or misinterpretation. In those days, Vaishnavism was looked down upon, and Krishna would be also looked down upon because of being with the devotees and all this, the kind of ethical
Protestantism that the missionaries had introduced to Bengal had influenced the middle class.
So they thought that Chaitanya Vaishnavism and Krishna Bhakti was something actually cheap.
So he used to debate with them.
And he said that he wouldn't touch even water unless he had cheap it.
And then it says also, the main activity of this assembly, he founded an assembly called Alabhut Society.
But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he felt very early that looking at the example of his own father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, ethics was very important to religion. In other words, unless you, as a practitioner, you follow some basic ethical rules, then
whatever one talks about religion or spirituality cannot be really authentic.
It becomes very cheap.
So he founded the August Society in 1891, and that was really a group of friends.
It wasn't really an official society. But many very prominent youths in Calcutta became members of this society, and some of them took vows of lifelong celibacy.
Later on, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati went to the Sanskrit college.
I'm telling you this always just to give you an idea of what kind of exposure he had. He tells that he went to Sanskrit college, he met the most prominent intellectual of Calcutta those days, Vidyasagar, and the vice chancellor of Calcutta University. He met Charles Eliot, who was the governor of Bengal, all kinds of people, also through the fact that his father was the prominent employee of the government. So kind of all doors were open, so to speak.
And while he was at Sanskrit College, he started to read with all kinds of Western philosophy, utilitarianism.
His passion was to, before critiquing something, he had to understand it. So that's why he read all kinds of philosophies,
just to get a hold of it and get a grasp of it.
As he was growing, of course, his family and even Bhaktivinoda Thakur were thinking about his future. And he started to read books about the lives of sadhus and became very much fascinated by the simple life of a sadhu. He felt that the best way to be a spiritual person in the world was to live as simply as possible. So therefore, as he was getting well educated, and it was kind of obvious that he had many qualifications, he could actually get a very good job. He decided that, if somebody offers me a good position, I will accept the lower one. So he got a very good offer at the government, but then he refused it and took a very low post in the post office in Calcutta, so that he could stay poor and simple and study and practice Bhakti. So at some point, his father arranged that he went to Tripura, and then he worked there for some time as the official historian of the Manikya dynasty, the royal dynasty of Tripura, that Bhaktivinoda Thakur was very close to. And there also, there was a gigantic library, and he continued reading, and he tells indeed of what kind of books he was reading. It was a lot. He used to have a passion of taking a book, and in the shortest possible time, understand what were the main points of the book, and then go to the next.
So this gives us a little idea of what kind of personality he was, what was his background. In 1899,
we're getting closest to his point of conversion. His interest in spirituality gradually increases. He writes a book called Bhongi
Shamajikata, which is translated roughly the Sociality of Bengal.
This book is a kind of amazing book because it doesn't have any references. like when you read it through, it's in a very difficult Bengali also, it's kind of Sanskritized Bengali. When you read it, there are no references. So it seems like it's just somebody kind of reading it, or just writing something. So I gave this book to some professors, the wife of Gombrich, Sanjuta Gupta. She's a very great intellectual. She went to the Sanskrit College in Calcutta, so she knows very well the background of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. So when I gave her the book, initially she thought these are just, you know, somebody expresses some ideas. There are no references, they're not here. But then as she was reading it, she found out that this person knows a lot. He really knows what he's talking about, and actually has a very clear understanding of the situation in those days.
So she became quite fascinating. So the book is a kind of summary
of all the impressions he had gained during his early life. It describes in detail the society of Bengal, and then there is a whole section, second section of the book, that explains Varma, the religion of Bengal. And he gave a very detailed overview of 60 different religious currents in Bengal in those days, including Christianity, Islam, and of course a large variety of Hindu currents and Islam and so on and so forth.
So what I want to show
with this is that here we have a person who is extremely well informed. He's not a person who is very narrow-minded, he's very broad-minded, and he has a very wide exposure to the culture and society and religion of his time.
So the two major influences of his life were his father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and his what became his guru, his ascetic guru, Guru Kishordas Babaji.
And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati received a very thorough education in Bhakti with Bhaktivinoda Thakur as they were studying Bhaktivinoda Thakur's own books together.
He received from Guru Kishordas Babaji something else. This is from a translation of a section of his autobiography. Before I met Gaura Kishordas Babaji, my impression was that the writings of the devotional school could not be fully realized in practical life in this world.
In other words, simply esoteric.
My study of my master, Gaura Kishordas Babaji, and the study of the books along with explanations by Thakur Bhaktivinod gave me ample facility to advance towards true spiritual life. Before I met my master, my idea of religion was confined to books and to a strict ethical life, but that sort of life was found imperfect unless I came in touch with the practical side of things.
So, his understanding of Bhakti up to this point was basically ethical. The Bhakta is somebody performing sadhana very strictly and follows strict ethical rules and establishing the kind of platform of purity where Bhakti actually can develop and grow. And the other side of his practice was philosophical and through studies and education.
But then, when he saw Guru Kishordas
Babaji, something happened.
And he described this in other places.
Let me see if you can hear. Bhaktisiddhanta provided further details of his relationship with Guru Kishore. In two 1970 articles that were published in the Sajjana Purushani, there was a magazine that Bhaktivinoda Thakur had started and he had taken over. They were titled Amar Prabhu Katha, or Tales About My Master. In his accounts, he confesses that his education, sharp intellect, and social status had made him a little proud, and that Bhaktivinoda had cleverly directed him to approach Guru Kishore, who evinced not the slightest regard for his so-called worldly confidence and intellectual achievements. According to Bhaktisiddhanta himself, this utter indifference induced him to take a hard look inside, curing him of his youthful pride. Bhaktisiddhanta recounted that he had met someone who showed him not only how to live in the world, but how to develop his character as well. Noting Saraswati's honesty and sincerity, Guru Kishore suggested that he reside nearby. And Saraswati departed Calcutta to make his case in Nayapur.
In other words, Guru Kishore Dasavaji, who was illiterate,
and very extreme ascetic. The stories of where he used to live under turnaround boats lying on the shores of the Ganges.
He would dress with clothes that he would find in the crematory places. Very extreme kind of austerity. This person touched his heart because of his sincerity, and he started to follow and imitate in the path of bhakti, because he saw the kind of devotion. Let me see, just a few more lines.
From Bhaktivinoda Saraswati had acquired social and cultural competence, the sense of societal involvement, and the vision of the Vaishnava society that would impact the modern world. From Bhaktivinoda he obtained something very different. The Bhakti was literate, highly unconventional, and wholly unconcerned with the social-political aspects of life. Moreover, he steadfastly avoided public exposure, despite the fact that his spiritual reputation attracted rich and powerful patrons. What he was able to provide, however, was a keen appreciation for the intimate practice of Raghunuga Bhakti, by which one worshipped Sri Krishna and his consort in the mood of separation, Kikaranda, a form of devotional service pursued by highly elevated Vaishnavas in Vrindavan and other people.
So, through this transformation, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati changed his life completely and renounced his family, moved to Mayapur, and started to fully focus on bhakti. Oh, one more thing before we go on. At the same time, the influence of Bhaktivinoda Thakur was there. Bhaktivinoda Thakur left his body in 1914, and a few months later, Guru Kishore started his life. And Bhaktisiddhanta was meditating on how to combine or absorb both kind of inheritances that he had received from his masters. And from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he had a strong inclination for austerity in the life of the sadhu. At the same time, through Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he had gained the understanding that bhakti should have an influence in society, it should impact the society in a positive way. And the results you can see here, taking sannyas, this is a picture taken 2 days after, on March 29, 1918.
He gave himself the order of sannyas, which was not there previously in the
Gaudiya tradition of Bengal. And in this way, launched into a life of service to the society. So, what were the strategies of preaching? Preaching here, in this sense, as I mentioned earlier, means communication. How to communicate the message of bhakti in the modern world, in a way, in a meaningful way. So, in terms of education, in 1927 he wrote an article to present a new magazine called The Harmonist in English. And in the introductory volume he kind of explained a little bit the purpose of the magazine. So the first purpose was to educate the intellectuals, the readers, if you like, to put a personalist theology at the center. To establish the understanding of the divine as a personality. And to understand this fully, we have to be aware of the background, the religious cultural background of India and Bengal in those days, dominated by the attraction of the Bengali middle class called Bhadralok. This Bhadralok is the gentle people, translated in English. Their attraction for interpretation of Hinduism developed by Ram Mohan Roy and Vivekananda and many scholars throughout the 19th century and early 20th century, which had kind of redefined Hinduism in terms of Advaita Vedanta, in terms of distancing themselves from iconic worship of deities. In other words, creating a kind of religious understanding of Hinduism that was quite disconnected with a popular understanding of
the masses, the Hindu masses, which were prone to worship deities and perform bhakti and so on and so forth. Their understanding was a rejection of this. They understood this to be something degrading. And their religion was rational, was leaning toward an abstract, impersonal understanding of the Supreme. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati tried to counteract that through processes of writing texts, producing journals and magazines, and put a personalist understanding of the divine at the center.
And also establishing Yukta Vairagya,
a principle that is extracted from the Goswami Institute of where there are discussions between Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Sanatana Goswami
about
what is renunciation, and the idea of Phagu and Yukta Vairagya.
So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati understood that
renunciation is the least placed word, because we cannot renounce something we don't possess. And within bhakti, if we accept the understanding that everything belongs to the Supreme, then actually we have nothing to renounce because we don't own it. But we can only use these energies in the best possible way, that is, in the service of the owner,
of God. So, so Yukta Vairagya meant basically that anything, almost anything like this, could be used in God's service.
Instead of rejecting things, instead of saying no, one could transform the use and the mentality behind
the use of material objects
for a spiritual purpose.
Which was a very powerful concept,
which meant that even monks, even sannyasis, for example, like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, who ride a car, could go and associate with very rich, wealthy people, being all kinds of environments, for a spiritual purpose. And in this way, practice renunciation at the same time,
which was quite revolutionary.
And which many of his fellow Bhadra Vidyas kind of looked with suspicion.
And then transmitted the truth through a positive and negative methodology.
As if you remember, we discussed about the discussion for debate. So one could think that this was a useful way of competing and winning over
opponents. But there was something also more behind it, because
Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati believed deeply that if you want to present the truth, or any truth, the best way to do it is to present its opposite. In this way, truth, something which many people may take as totally obvious, becomes enhanced, becomes beautified, and more interesting.
So this is explained in this very nice article in The Harmonist. So what were the strategies within the Gaudiya Math for education and conversion? On one platform, there was no idea of conversion or converting anyone, because, as I said, the idea in Bengali and India in those days was that personalism and Vaishnava Bhakti was being misinterpreted in very fundamental ways. It needed to be established again. The idea of what Bhakti is, what Krishna Bhakti is, had been somehow lost. People were not reading the Bhagavatam, the middle class were not according to the Puranas anymore. They were reading the writings of Ramohan Roy and Vivekananda and so on and so forth. They had lost touch with their tradition, in other words. So the first aspect of this kind of cultural mission was to present in intelligible ways what was the core of Chaitanya Bhakti. This he did by writing, but this matter wrote very profusely. He didn't write many books, but constantly writing articles and in various languages. He had three, four secretaries, and some of the anecdotes that you can read is that he would easily have three or four secretaries in the front and dictate four different articles at the same time, just like taking one and then going back. Well, they were notating these points. So a very profuse kind of flow of publishing, writing, lecturing. And then in the center here, you can see it's a bit. But this is the atheistic exhibition, Dhaka, January 1933.
So in order to kind of awaken kind of interest, he liked the idea to make a very large exhibition with 80 or 90, 100 stalls. And this exhibition would be very comprehensive. It would show the latest technological advancements. There would be a section about economy and medicine and kind of worldly scientific areas. And then there will be a section depicting the religious life of India at large, different Hindu groups, their philosophies, their way of life. And then, of course, many kind of sections describing episodes of the Bhagavatam and describing bhakti in various ways. And then there will be guides, the Gaudiamats, Brahmacharis, they will be guiding people around and explaining. They will print, this is a brochure, 78 pages, explaining everything in English and Bengali. And in some of the reports, which are there in the harmonies, they might be exaggerated, but they talk about 1 million people coming there. And these were a very vast exhibition, so I mean it's difficult to count numbers. But it seems from the accounts that this became very popular and people actually appreciate it.
On the left you see a picture with Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati in most probably in Mayapur. He
developed a very good relationship with the Muslims. Mayapur was in the Muslim area, still is. There are many Muslims. The Hindus are on the other side of the Ganges in Punjab. So he developed this kind of attitude of always being very friendly to different kinds of people, whoever was around him. So he cultivated his friendship with Muslims who came to visit him from time to time, and this is one occasion.
Regarding conversion, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, his idea was that his experience of with Gaurdiya Shodasavati was a very powerful experience, almost shocking,
because he was an illiterate Gaurdiya Shodasavati, who couldn't care less about it. Education, about disposition, and so on. So he developed the idea that if you want to actually have an experience of conversion, the heart has to go to a very powerful experience. And that can be in the best possible scenario, so is the influential powerful guru who creates that experience. And in various ways. So he meant, in other words, that there was a need of a very strong experiences, or crisis, life crisis of some kind, and some very deep encounters with the spiritual personality in order to create or initiate the process of true conversion, not only a superficial yes, but kind of on a deeper level. For those who actually became part of the Gaudiya and became Brahmacharis or later sannyasis,
he had a very systematic program of training.
In 1918, he started his first center in Calcutta, in Uttaranga Road. And in the Amrita Bazar Patrika, which was the English newspaper in Calcutta, there is an article about what was going on in the center. And there is statements about that every evening there are lectures by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, morning explanations of different scriptural texts. So a very kind of tight program of education. Later on, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati introduced examinations, different levels of examinations, and awarded different kinds of degrees, like Bhakti Shastri and so on and so forth. And in communication with intellectuals or scholars, the members of the government would be very careful in putting their titles there, because the colonial times were the times of titles. So whenever you had any government officer represented, you had at least 20 different titles. And the more titles you had, the more respect you would receive. So they kind of follow that kind of line. But everyone, most members of the Gaudiya Math would be encouraged to take examinations and make serious studies of the scriptures. One interesting aspect, though, is that on the higher levels, it would not be only Gaudiya literature that would be studied by insiders. It would be also texts of the other sampradayas, even Shankara texts. In other words, an exposure to the philosophy of Vaishnavism in India at large and of Advaita Vedanta.
So it was a very comprehensive curriculum, and there are statements of what this curriculum was about. And this leads us to the Bhaktivinoda Institute. The Bhaktivinoda Institute was created by Bhaktisiddhanta in 1931 as a public school. That means everybody was welcome, even Muslims and Hindus, Vaishnavas, all kinds of groups were welcome. And it was supervised by the government. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati made an agreement with Karthi University so that the students from the college, it was from class 4 to 10, they could candidate for the examination, to enter the university. Matriculation or, yes, entrance examination for Calcutta University. And this is a brochure of the Bhaktivinoda Institute. And at the highest point, this had about 700 students. And the teachers were qualified teachers, educated teachers, but they were members of the Gaudiya Math also. And there was the ashram, the Chaitanya Math, close by, so they would get associations with the sannyasis also. So, and the brochure speaks about, to be exact, religious and moral education, that the children live in a very in a spiritual environment, they will associate with saintly persons, the teacher would be a devotional teacher, but there would be no force in converting them, it wouldn't just be a public school. But the idea is to give them association. And there is some article also about the problems they had with the public, with the authorities, about, for example, having a fellowship and having days of fasting, and the ways they were trying to negotiate with them to have at least a minimum Vaishnava program. An interesting thing was a debating club, of course. The students would be trained to debate about different issues. And then there would be a quite comprehensive library in Kier State with the Institute of Legal Sanity. So it's in many ways was a very ambitious program. And that was stopped in the 1940s, I think, because of the internal crisis of the Gaudiya Math. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati never really left this his idea of having this kind of broad educational program, not only to educate the insiders of the Gaudiya Math, but also the public. So in the library of Sundaranandan Vidyanoda, I found he was the secretary, so they were also the last wishes of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And they were given on 31st of December 1936, 10:30 a.m. He let his body the day after. And there also we see that he asked Sundaranandan Vidyanoda, his secretary, to edit a Manjusha, one of his most ambitious programs. The Manjusha was a
Vaishnava encyclopedia, where he wanted to kind of define all the different Vaishnava terms and give a very precise explanation of what they mean, with the idea that Vaishnavism or the idea of Vaishnava Bhakti has been lost or misunderstood.
He published four volumes of this Manjusha, but it was meant to be a very large encyclopedic work. And then he encouraged another of his closest associates, Ananta Vasudev, to execute bhajan and kirtan, but also have helped Bhakti Sudhakar Prabhu, Nishikanta Sanyal,
who was a professor of Chittagong University, one of his disciples who
used to write some of the literature in English, and Sundarananda Vidyavinoda.
In other words, he meant that this process of presenting bhakti to the large, to the public, in an innovative way, was a continuous effort. It should not stop.
Then I would like to present a few points about his approach to the West, as we are getting closer to the last stages of this presentation. As I mentioned earlier, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati believed that one can use basically almost everything in different service. So he could chase a Chevrolet, and in the desire there is also stated very clearly, money paid every month to pay off the Chevrolet. His idea is that if you want to meet a king, you cannot come
just walking, we need an elephant for the car. So because he wanted actually to approach the upper middle class, so influential people to talk about Bhakti, so he purchased a car, so it would make a very elegant entrance in the palaces of various wealthy and influential people.
And on the right, you see, as I mentioned earlier, Bhaktisiddhanta
Saraswati was exposed to the British, to Colombia's government officers and intellectuals at the Calcutta University because of his father and his education. So he was quite used to deal with Western people. He spoke a very elegant, archaic, perhaps in many ways, but a very elegant and pointed English that never stopped to fascinate the British.
And here is a picture on the right when Bhaktisiddhanta received
the governor of Bengal, John Anderson. He invited him to come to Mayapur, which in those days was basically a jungle, and built a road for him so that he could come with a car and his associates.
On the top you see God bless the king,
which was a very controversial statement. This is 1935. This is in the middle of independence movements. A lot of nationalistic
things going on. But this is to point not only that
he was open to a dialogue with the colonial Western people, in this case the British, but also that he saw that God is everybody's. It's not that this is our God, this is your God. God, as the king, is also a servant of God, and therefore we can share that kind of vocabulary.
When we talk about preaching to the West,
Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati appears to have had more the approach of sharing, more than kind of,
I think Krishna Chaitanya was using this word of Digvijaya, going there and conquering the West.
He made a statement to to the persons that he sent to London and Germany.
Those nations to whom you are going for the propagation of the chant of Hari, that means England and Germany, are mounted on the summit of proficiency in all affairs of the world. Their practice in the exercise of rational judgment are endowed with the qualities of good manners and are superior and glorious in many respects. Therefore, we should maintain our hope unshaken that they will prove to be the worthiest recipients of the heard transcendental voice if we unlock to them the gates of the natural exhibition of abiding arguments and enduring judgments.
In other words, he believed that just by sharing Krishna consciousness, because he actually thought quite highly about the Westerners in many ways, that they would naturally accept it because of their good judgments. In other words, they would see something good, something nice, and they would naturally want to have it.
So in England, the missionaries were on the right. You see Hriday Bon Maharaj on the upper right, and then Bhakti Pradip Tirtha Swami on the upper left. This is the board of the Gaudiya Mission, which was founded in London in 1933-34. On the middle lower, you see Lord Zetlan. He was the Secretary of State of India, which was assigned the highest position in the government.
In other words, he was representing the whole of India in the British cabinet. So he was representing 300 million people.
So he had been a governor of Bengal earlier and had developed a sympathy for Bhakti, Chaitanya Bhakti. So he agreed to be the president of the Gaudiya Mission.
And you can imagine how revolutionary that was, to take a politician of that position and make him the president of the mission in London.
And then you have two ladies, two aristocrats. This is also quite revolutionary for a kind of monastic movement with sannyasis. You have two sannyasis, and then the Maharaj of Burban in the middle, the big Maharaj. So that gives an idea of what kind of programs they were pursuing.
Something open, something especially directed to creating good networks, kind of appreciation among the influential classes in Great Britain. This is in the heart of London.
And in this way, creating the basis for presenting Chaitanya Bhakti, Krishna Bhakti. Another point is to put emphasis on Chaitanya instead of emphasizing Krishna Bhakti.
the plan was to present Chaitanya, because Krishna had developed a bad reputation, so to speak, among the Westerners, because of truly
misunderstanding, in many ways misunderstanding about the Rasa Lila and relationship with the gopis. But that it was very difficult even for missionaries or scholars to critique Chaitanya in ethical terms, because he lived as a sannyasi and he lived a very pure life. So Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati encouraged the writing of this Krishna Chaitanya, which is a biography of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in English in two volumes, presented in a kind of academic rational language. Regarding academics, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati financed a PhD at the University of London, done by one of his disciples, Sambhidananda Das. He wrote a thesis called The History and Literature of the Gaudiya Vaishnavas and Their Relation to Other Medieval Vaishnava Schools, that he defended in June 1935. So Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati paid for it, and much of the research behind the thesis is based on Bhaktisiddhanta's own research in India. So this was part of his plan to actually give a different understanding, give out or educate, if you like, scholars and intellectuals in the West about what is Gaudiya Vaishnavism in a more authentic way. In Germany, this is very short, the process was meant to present Chaitanya Vaishnavism in a way that Germans could relate to in those days, that there was through the idea of the Aryans. And the emissaries of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, under his supervision, tried to present Gaudiya Vaishnavism as true Aryanism, that the real essence of Aryanism is devotion to God, and especially personified by Vaishnava Bhakti. That was not very much appreciated. This was this is an article in the Turkish Haberdasher, the popular observer, which was the official magazine of Nazi Germany, and where they describe some of the lectures that were given by von Maharaj in Germany. And of course, they totally disagreed to the idea of race, that actually we are not as far in the spirit souls, and that the character of people, even the spiritual character of people, is defined by the place of birth, in the place one is born. The philosophy of Bhakti, that Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati presented, was that actually that didn't matter very much, because the soul is transcendental. So this was an article that basically closed the German chapter, and the article ends with this kind of philosophy about spirituality and that the love and race have no real importance, has no place in today's German. It was in 1935. There were a few Westerners who got interested. Actually, the mission was very short, about 2 years. It was really exploratory. Von Maharaj met with the most prominent intellectuals in Germany, like Karl Barth and Winter Hauer, who was the father of the faith movements in Germany that became very popular in the 90s. He met theologians and different scholars in public theology. But it was basically explorative to see what could be the interest in Chaitanya Bhakti. But some people became interested, and one person, Ernst Georg Schulze, who became later Sadananda Das, was basically the only European who left Europe and went to Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati to get some training. And he actually embraced the life of the Vaishnava, he shaved up and put his head on, and went to live as a sadhu with Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. And with him, because he was interested, and he came up himself, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati shared some of his thoughts. And just the last part is interesting. To walk back is the first stage of walking in the path of spiritual living. The neophyte is required to offer his loyal, unlearning submission.
So to him, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was speak differently. That if you want to follow the true life of the sadhu, you should basically forget whatever you learned earlier and relearn everything from the point of view of bhakti. So there will be a different kind of approach. While for the broader, for broader audiences, he would encourage another kind of discussion and approach. This is a letter from to Sadananda that Bhaktisiddhanta wrote in English in 1934. So I think I talked about the outcome. As time is running out, I think we have to close down a little bit. So what does this all tell us?
Of course, it's very fascinating. The life and deeds of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati are very inspiring.
What I wanted to try to do here today is to show that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati thought about preaching, education and conversion in very broad terms. And because of his own background and his kind of large, very broad exposure to different social, cultural, political environments, he was able to address different target groups in different ways, in appropriate ways. So this is what I'm going to present now is a bit tentative. It's just meant to be a kind of reflection about how, what kind of thoughts the example of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati may give rise to. And I thought to, just to get into to show a little bit the contrast between the kind of preaching environment, the mission environment of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, in many ways the upper middle, upper classes, the politicians, intellectuals of his times, both in India and in the West. I just want to show briefly, just to get into the mood, Srila Prabhupada singing kirtan in San Francisco in 1967.
This is not meant to be in a negative, in a negative way. I will try to contextualize this after that. But just to give you an idea,
and turn the mind more to times closer to us, let's look at it for a few seconds. Srila Prabhupada, when he came to the West, he found a favorable environment. What we saw here, I mean, besides that people were taking drugs and kind of behaving very aggressively in different ways, we can see a group of, a large section of society actually in the 60s exploring the possibility of a different lifestyle, being very attracted to spirituality, experimenting. We were discussing about California, this was San Francisco, but just the way of exploring alternative lifestyles, alternative perspectives
on the meaning of life.
And many times, you were qualified to say things about that, but my feeling, which I, by different discussion with different devotees from the States, is actually much of the counterculture in the States where the consciousness was born. Came from actually middle class and upper middle class youth. They were not kind of the lowest, the rejects of society. They were actually, in many cases, well educated, in many from good families. And this was more, for them, was kind of a protest. A symptom perhaps of a generation that was not any more interested in security, accumulating money or doing a career in life, but wanted to actually find another kind of satisfaction
in terms of meaning of life, spirituality, and so on and so forth. A different kind of generation.
So one interesting thought that which I developed from some devotees is actually why at some point Srila Prabhupada wanted to have communities and
in some ways creating something which was very different from the rest. Discussing at length about the falling conditions of Western society and Western civilization. Why would Prabhupada want to do that to such a degree? Because sometimes he went a great length in doing that.
One possible option is that he did that because the audience wanted to hear that.
I mean, this generation that Srila Prabhupada was leading, which this youth movement, counterculture movement, spread from the States to Europe and gradually all over the world.
There was a generation which wanted actually to take distance from the materialism and what Western society had to offer, and was ready to embrace a very radical lifestyle and really change their life in many ways completely and radically. So one thought is that if we compare, so to speak, the way Krishna consciousness developed in the West and the way Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had a kind of very flexible approach to preaching and education, we may think that times have changed, the counterculture is not there anymore, the audience, so the Western society, those who are the candidates of receiving the sharing of bhakti and Krishna consciousness, their mindset, their desires, their life is fundamentally different. And therefore, that kind of approach, which was very relevant and absolutely necessary in the 60s and 70s, or maybe the 80s, maybe it's not equally valuable today. When I was in the Donner Institute to receive the prize, I was quite surprised by the way people, scholars in Finland, but also in other scholars in Scandinavia, were talking about the post-secularization stage, that actually Western society is going through a stage of desecularization, where people can now speak about being a Christian, or being a Hindu, or being a Hare Krishna, and actually secular people don't freak out anymore in saying like that before. You can actually be a normal, a modern person, and you can be also a religious person at the same time. There are many scholars discussing this at this stage. One of the most well quoted is Aishita,
who has developed the theory of multiple modernities. In other words, the way modernity has been understood up to the turn of the century, I think that modernity means secularization, that society is meant to be more and more secular, religion is meant to be more and more privatized and marginalized. But what's happening really is the opposite, that there are symptoms in the global society where people want to be more religious, want to be more open about it. And scholars talk in this conference, particularly a number of scholars who had a project about studying how religion and secularism, the kind of the borders between secularism and religiosity kind of emerge more and more. And people don't wish to make these distinctions very clear.
Yeah, 5 minutes. So this leads us to a point which I think Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati presented, is that he really wanted to make Krishna consciousness part of the ministry.
He was not really satisfied to have a community of sadhus living in my world or on the border of society, or being considered less intelligent, very strange, or anomalous tribes or culture. But he really wanted to make a contribution to mainstream society. And I think that ISKCON as an organization, as we are talking about in this conference, is submissive to study.
There are possibilities for ISKCON, that there should be, I think, possibilities to kind of think the kind of approach ISKCON as a society has to the outside world in order to find new creative, innovative ways to enter society. And there are many examples of this. introducing systematic education, theology,
academic studies, I was discussing with Barbara, yoga, entering the yoga scene, which is very big in the West, even in Sweden.
So my time is up, and I want to conclude by saying that processes of religious conversion in the contemporary West can take various shapes and tend to be non-exclusive.
That means people nowadays tend to be non-exclusive and can understand that can be many things at the same time. In other words, they may take up the path of bhakti, but they might not want it to do it in an exclusive way. They might want to share that identity with other important identities.
So we have to consider that as well. In the case of Bhaktisiddhanta, the process of successfully preaching religious ideas implied a continuous reshaping of the religious method for retaining its intelligibility and relevance to changing times, cultural settings, Britain and Germany, and personal needs. His preaching for broader education and narrow conversions were flexible, experimental, innovative, while retaining key principles of the tradition, like, for example, Yuktha Vairagya. The life and work of Bhaktisiddhanta suggests for ISKCON and its committed congregations the possibility of building new bridges between its narrow temple and ashram traditions, which are required, and broader local communities, opening up for its various members and sympathizers the possibility of accepting inclusive and productive roles of responsible citizenship in the local, cultural, political, and social spheres. A bit too long, I guess.
One thing that struck me when you were talking about Valentine's sort of pointing out some of the things. One is this sort of stress on ethics. You were talking about the desire to become basically a sadhu, but then he became sannyasi. He sort of gave himself sannyasi because there is no sannyasi in the Gaudiya tradition, but the idea was to sort of give back to society. The idea of Yuktha Vairagya and sort of bringing in Western technology. And the emphasis on the West, a lot of that I was reminded of Vivekananda, actually, who was, of course, active slightly earlier than this, but who had the same sort of emphasis on ethics, had the same idea of sort of an organized sannyasi mission, where the sannyasi is going to sort of retire from society, to sort of return to society. The idea of Yuktha Vairagya sort of reminded me of the lame and the blind image of Vivekananda, where the West is blind as an illusion, who is capable of doing a lot of stuff, and so sort of combining the technological expertise of the West with the illusion of the East. And the West, of course, I was wondering to what extent this Pakistan's interest in the West was fueled by Vivekananda's big desire in the West. We sort of had as far as I know, that's sort of quite a bit of caused quite some ripples in India.
Yes, definitely.
And the only difference the strong difference that I can see is one is, of course, the Bhakti versus the Advaita kind of mm-hmm. opposition.
Yep.
And the Kanana does have a strong sort of independence drive, kind of sort of India should become independent.
Yes,
yeah,
so
so my question is basically, to what extent was there is the influence by Vivekananda? Did he know Vivekananda? What was the interaction between Bhaktisiddhanta and the Ramakrishna mission? And so on. Is there any, or is it just sort of just a symptom of the times that?
No, it's one of the secretaries put behind the illusion of was actually prevented on Ramakrishna mission. Before he invited Bhaktisiddhanta to come to Prakrat and start the tour center. There is many of these people from the Ramakrishna mission.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sorry. Actually, I read a letter, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati wrote in a letter that actually he didn't want to start a large preaching movement, like criticizes the Smarta Brahmanas, critique the Goswamis, and start a whole season for spreading, so to speak, bhakti, perhaps in some ways using the Vijaya platform. But he was deeply disturbed by the fact that because of this kind of power relationship within Gaudiya Vaishnavas, because of the Smarta Brahmanas and the Goswamis, many Vaishnavas suffered socially, personally. It felt that the society was imbalanced. So he had to get into the social system, disturb the peace of the Hindu society, just to create a better, improved situation for the people, actually, for the Vaishnavas. Another thing is that, as far as through my readings, my perception of this is that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati understood that India and the West were totally linked. So if he wanted to present Bhakti, Krishna Bhakti, in India, he had to approach the West. Because of the colonial system, the colonial education was tremendously influential through the Calcutta University, Bombay University, and so on and so forth. So he actually wanted to go to the roots of it, colonial London, and talked and discussed with the professors there, sent his disciples to make PhDs there, to convince them or to present a different image for Bhakti. And in this way, going back to India and improving the situation there. That's at least my understanding.
Well, I'm not here, so we have another question.
Yeah?
So is it the same question, if it wasn't there, was it influenced by this commitment?
Yes, it was. It definitely was. The idea of having religious institutions to have ashrams, this thing came out with Brahm Samaj in the 19th century, the idea of having groups of sadhus living in the cities. It wasn't there before. It was introduced by Brahm Samaj. Vivekananda applied that. Of course, he was frequented by Brahm Samaj. Applied that to create a Ramakrishna mission. And that's when Bhaktisiddhanta started to think about how to create a spiritual movement in the heart of the capital, not in Mayapur, Vrindavan, but in the very heart of the city. Obviously, he understood that the point of reference was the Ramakrishna mission because it was the most successful. Everybody talked about the Ramakrishna mission and Vivekananda. So, and the other point is that in those days in India, we're talking about the period of the nationalist movements. Many nationalists, many middle-class Hindus in general felt that India had fallen very deeply and was not able to rise. And the only way to really create a spirit of a strength in Hinduism, to really resist colonialism and go back to the traditional values of Indian life, was really through austerity and fasting. That's why Vivekananda becoming a sannyasi, a sadhu, and offering his life for India became tremendously popular because that's what really people wanted. And when Bhaktisiddhanta's Vaishnava sannyasi came and visited influential people, just by being dressed as a sannyasi, the message was, I'm working for you, for the society, I'm offering my life for the betterment, of our world. And in this way, immediately, there was respect. Thank you very much.